I'm not gonna lie, this was a brutal winter, guys, and after a brief spring, we have landed in summer, thank goodness. I'm ready to pack up the sweaters and get out the linen. I want those light fabrics that make us feel good the moment they're on our bodies, and that is why I love my Quince products. Did you know that Quince has elegant, everyday pieces like 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops with styles starting at $32? Remember that Quince is 50 to 80% less than similar brands because you're paying for quality, not brand markup. If you haven't checked them out in a while, they're now a destination for home, kitchen, bedding, and beyond. So make sure you get their pieces that bring a premium feeling to everyday life. I am newly in love with my 100% European linen shorts. Something I can wear to the park or dress up. They're thick enough to have some structure, but light enough to feel wearable all summer long. I'll be in mine every week. I have them in black, but there are 11 colors to choose from. There are 4,261 reviews, all averaging 5 stars. Made with European flax and machine washable, I'm going to need another pair. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/cheesenotya for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/cheesenotya.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, "My story gets better in chapter two." I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right: How to Begin Your Story in the Best Place and in the Best Way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter two. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.
There and welcome to our show, the shit no one tells you about writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. It is one of your author interviews with Carly today. Griffin Bianca, some time off. And I have so many wonderful authors to have on the show lately because I have so many authors with books coming out. And today I have my client, Laura Stokes, on the show. We have so much to talk about. Everything from the story of how we started working together to how many projects we've worked on together to her new novel, Midsummer Nights. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Laura and then I will let her tell you about the book. So Laura Stokes studied theater and creative writing at York University, where she was the recipient of the B.P. Nichol Award and the Judith Eve Gerwitz Award. Her work has appeared in the Danforth Review and the Ottawa Arts Review, among others. Born and raised in Northern Ontario, she now lives in Kawartha Lakes, Ontario. And you can check her out online at laurastokeswriter.com. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm a big fan, so I'm very excited to be talking to you.
I know. Oh, it's so good. I'm like, we've been waiting for this moment to have you on the show. We have so much to talk about. We worked together for a long time, but today we are talking about this book. If you guys are watching on YouTube, I'm holding it up. Midsummer Nights. This is your debut novel. Why don't you tell everybody what it's about?
Okay, so Midsummer Nights is a very loose spin on A Midsummer Night's Dream. It follows a actress named Miranda who has sort of bombed out her whole life, her career, her relationship. And the only opportunity that really exists for her is a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream in her hometown, directed by her parents and starring her ex-boyfriend. And it sort of follows her journey through failure and falling back in love with her craft as an actor, her hometown, her family, and a few scoundrels and love interests along the way.
Yeah, and curses and all the things going wrong so that everything can go right.
Yes, meddling fairies. It's lots of fun.
Yes. Oh, it's the best. I'm so excited. So this one comes out at the end of the month, June 30th. We're so excited for everybody to read it. And yeah, so let's get into the interview portion of the conversation. So we started working together a number of years ago, and this project was not the book that we started working together on. Do you want to run everybody through the beginnings of your writing career and how we came to be working together?
Yeah. So I studied creative writing at York University in Toronto. And I also was a full-time teacher for many years. And I sort of was always juggling the teaching and the writing. And around 2019, 2020, I was working on a memoir. I had a hip replacement at 32 and it kind of derailed my whole life. And I wrote a very intense, emotional memoir about it. And I pitched Carly and one other agent at a conference. Now, this was summer 2020, a highlight for all of us, the peak COVID. And I don't know if you know this, but I tried to cancel our meeting. The book wasn't done. I was like, what am I doing? I was so totally petrified to query. I was like, what's the most intense extreme version of this? I'm going to pitch in person, even though it was not really in person, it was online because COVID. But I was like, I just need to get over this fear, so I'm going to do this as an exercise. I tried to cancel. They were like, please don't do that, like, just administratively, please don't do that to us. But yeah, I fully tried to bail, and I met with you were wonderful. You liked the book. The other agent was wonderful. She liked the book. You both asked for pages. You asked for part. The other agent asked for full when it was done. Long story short, you and I kind of started the process. By the time I had a full draft, you had already offered, and I was unable to send it to the other agent, which is good because she had joined your agency and you'd started a damn podcast together because it was Cece. And so, yeah. So, hi, Cece, I love you. And we were all meant to be together in some capacity here. So, yes. So that's how we started working together. And then we were pitching a sad medical memoir about isolation and mental health during COVID. And that didn't sell, oddly enough, at that time. But it was an experiment for me in, do I have a book in me? And can I get an agent? And I did. And then I worked on a novel because I was like, okay, I have a book in me, but do I have a novel in me? And I wrote a novel and we worked on that for a while, and it got pretty close, pretty darn close.
The heartbreaking close you're all thinking of. Yeah. So close.
Yeah. But it was not to be. And there's a rewrite in a drawer, the proverbial drawer of that. And then I was really pissed off and feeling like a failure. This was when I decided I should quit my full-time job with benefits and a pension while I was on submission for a book that was not selling. Don't try this at home, kids. And I found myself without a job. I was trying to get at work as a substitute teacher, and I just couldn't like get on any of these supply lists. And I found myself without anything suddenly. And I said, okay, every day that I don't have work, I'm going to get up and I'm going to write. And I had already started this book that I was really just writing for fun. I was really writing just, I needed to do something to amuse myself, something that was light, something that was a little less intense. And I wrote every day, and I kind of banged out this fun theater book. And, you know, lo and behold, there she is. Lo and behold, the thing I wrote when I was relaxed and just in a free creative state is the thing that sold. And here we are. That's the saga.
I know, that's the wonderful story. And yes, how full circle that you're on the show to talk about pitching both me and Cece. So that's a whole other thing we can dive into. But obviously, I'm so glad that you are on my list. And as you guys who are listening can very clearly see that Lara is very funny. So this medical memoir that clearly was very dark, it was so full of voice. And I just knew whatever you wrote was going to be great because you just have this voice. Like, this is the thing that we can't teach. This is the thing where, you know, we can talk about structure all day long, we can work on pace, but you have the voice, and I always knew you had the thing.
Thank you.
And I was never giving up on you.
Thank you.
One of the things that I think you had to balance as you were kind of coming to terms with what type of book you wanted to write and the type of author you wanted to be was this idea of like the author, how serious do I want to be? When you had this very funny voice, but I know that you wanted to be in some ways, and not to say, you know, or diminish any type of genre, but I think you had this idea of yourself maybe as like a capital L literary writer, or aspirations of the seriousness that you wanted to write with. But having this funny voice, and, you know, you do balance. And this is the theme with a lot of my clients' books, right? But like balancing tough things and hard things with heart and humor. And you ended up selling the book that was the most commercial book, I believe. I mean, I would argue that you have written, and you talked about it being more fun and relaxed. Can you talk about how you kind of came to terms with like the top type of author that you wanted to be, and how that kind of settled in you?
Yeah. My dad is a poet. He's a really, really brilliant poet, Dennis Stokes. And he was my writer's craft teacher in high school. Twice. So I grew up with this incredible literary writer, and I've been immersed and exposed to that world my whole life. I am in a family of readers, and like, we quote Shakespeare at each other for sport. Commercial fiction was not something that was around my home much. I worked in a library in university. And even before that, I lived in a very small town. The library was tiny, so I kind of read everything. So I would read all the literary stuff, but I was also reading like Sweet Valley High and, you know, The Babysitter's Club and anything. And I was reading it over and over and over again. So I was always reading in a lot of different genres. I studied creative writing at university, and that's a very literary world. So that's kind of all that anyone's doing. And it's sort of all that's respected. But I was also studying playwriting. I had a double major. And so in the playwriting space is where I was really developing my voice, and where the humor, and there was just like a lot more energy. And so I was, and I've kind of always been really grounded in, you know, literary training sounds like such a pretentious word, but that's how I was learning. But then applying it into this very voicey, very loose, very free other medium of theater. So I think that's like where they've merged, where like my scenes and my dialogue have a very different tone or different energy to, you know, more narrative prose, because that's been another totally separate medium I've been working in. And that taught me a lot about voice, because in theater, it's only the voice. It's only it's only the dialogue. Even the stage directions are up to, you know, interpretation. So I got pretty good at letting the words my character say be all. And then, and you and I have had a lot of conversation about literary versus upmarket versus commercial. And I mean, I kind of, and this is something that's like, I'm not ashamed of, but it feels tricky to say, which is that I kind of consciously was like, I kept hearing, we don't know what lane you're in. We don't know if this is literary, if this is commercial. My first novel really does ride the line. And I was like, I just want to write something that's, I want to try writing something that's going to sell. That's going to be, you know, my version of a commercial book, my version of romantic comedy. I learned in the process that I'm not like a capital R romance author. Writing sex scenes is like a gift. Like, I bow to people who can do that organically. It's, for me, it was like a very messy game of like Twister, like left hand, yellow.
That's how I edit them. I'm like, where is the right? Why is the two right hands? Like, what?
Yeah, yeah. It's not where I thrive. So, I mean, learning how to kind of ride those lines and find my own flow in it. But I didn't write this thinking about that. I just kind of was like, use that as a starting off point. Like, okay, what is my version of a romantic comedy? And it wasn't even Shakespeare initially. It wasn't specifically like, I'm going to write a Shakespeare book, but it kind of just turned into that. And kind of at the further end I got, the more I was like, once I had landed on A Midsummer Night's Dream, it was like all of these tropes, all these facets of our contemporary romantic comedy are like, they're all here. They're all, I don't want to say Shakespeare invented the rom-com, because we all know it was Nora Ephron, but but like, it gave me so much to work with, which was really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a few things I wanted to, a few threads I wanted to pull on there. One of them about like not knowing where your lane is, right? Because I think a lot of writers hear that. They're like, you know, don't already put you in. Nobody wants to be put in a box. But, you know, I think specifically with you figuring out how much of a book has to be romance in order for it to be a rom-com, or, you know, if there's not enough romance, like, where does it lie? Or does commercial fiction need a romance? You know, all of these things kind of came into play as you figured out the balance of, yeah, just like how much family drama versus, you know, how much of a love story. And for every book, there's going to be a different balance, right? There's no magic number or percentage of this part of the book has to be this. But I think that's what you were kind of working out through the book that died on sub, which we still love dearly, and we hope it finds another home. And this book, right, which I think you really, you know, through the medium of Shakespeare was able to kind of figure out exactly what that balance was. Okay, so can we talk a bit about why we think Shakespeare is still so relevant? I mean, obviously you touched on it as structure and all of these sorts of things, but I'm still always amazed by it, and we're always falling for these adaptations. I mean, She's the Man was just like an iconic movie of my youth. Yeah, so why do you think Shakespeare is still so relevant?
I think the classic writers kind of nailed down every nuance of humanity hundreds of years ago, and we're just riffing off of it. I think humans, you know, now we have cell phones and social media, but there's always new iterations of it, but there's always been the same core things. I think Shakespeare, I've thought about this a lot when I was writing the book. Shakespeare plays needed to be like literary and highbrow enough for the queen to come and deign to watch it. It had to be entertaining and nuanced enough to be appealing to the nobility, but it also had to have, like, you know, some dirty jokes and some like
accessibility.
Yeah. For the peasants who were, you know, standing like right up against the stage, and it had to sort of speak to everybody. And that really, there was something I thought about a lot. And it's something in Midsummer's, there's that hierarchy within the theater, within the structure of a play. But I was also like, this is sort of fun because I am making something that is hopefully appealing to a lot of people, that is really satisfying to lovers of contemporary romance, but that is also going to make I mean, my literary father, who is also a professor of creative writing, is going to make him laugh, which it did. He read it in front of me, just sitting there in front.
The whole thing?
Yeah, most of it. He read it very fast. And that's not a nice thing to do to your loved ones. Don't make them watch you read their book. But I think Shakespeare appeals because still these stories of love and fear and loss and grief and confusion are so relevant, but his plays are deliberately structured to appeal to the masses. You said She's the Man, but my touchstone was, I don't know if you ever saw this one, it was called Get Over It. And it was...
I was going to reference a different one. Things I Hate About You. Oh, I forgot to mention 10 Things I Hate About You.
Of course.
Which is like iconic. Yes.
But Get Over It is like a 2002 rom-com about a school play of Midsummer's. Mm-hmm. And Kirsten Dunst plays Helena, who is the character my main character plays. And I also played in a production of Midsummer Night's Dream. And it was just, you know... It was just like the coolest thing. Maybe I've just ripped off Get Over It, which I do with pride. But yeah, like, and still, I mean, Hamnet just came out, and that is so incredibly, I mean, it was incredible. It was gorgeous and so relevant. It was just these people, these humans on a journey. And we have Van Juliet playing on Broadway and in Toronto, and even Taylor Swift is playing Ophelia. I mean, Shakespeare is still everywhere. We're hooked.
I know. I couldn't have said it better myself. Going back to 10 Things I Hate About You. So when I was in Seattle at the Pacific Northwest Writers Conference, I actually went a couple days early so that I could drive around to all of the different sets, like the different places that the movie was filmed. So I went to like the high school.
Oh my God.
And I went to the house, like where the girls live with their dad. And anyway, so I was like a real, real 10 Things I Hate About You fan.
I've never loved you more. And hearing that, was it like something you researched, or is that available? Is that like a tour people can do, or is that just you being a little anthropologist?
I literally just had a rental car and a map.
Oh my God, you're my hero.
Yeah, wow. I drove all over. It was great. I'm sure there are like TikToks about this now, but this probably would have been 10 years ago, maybe more than 10 years
That's
ago,
amazing. 12
years ago. And so yes, I've been to everywhere that they filmed that movie, and it is still the best. And Julia Stiles adapted one of my client's books, Renee Carlino's book. And so I've met Julia Stiles, and anyway, she's the best. We could gush about it forever.
If she wants to do another, I mean, I'm available.
Another adaptation. All right. Okay. I'll get it to her. So what is your favorite scene in the book? I mean, we've kind of been talking about Shakespeare at large and you're writing for your at large, but let's talk about this book. I mean, it's so funny. It's so good. There's like, I mean, it's kind of a love triangle, but also kind of like a love quadrangle. Mm-hmm. I pitched it. I mean, there's fairies, there's all this family drama. It's also so just like community, small town centric in this like super Gilmore Girls way. I don't know. Like, what's your favorite part? I have so many favorite parts.
Without giving spoilers, my favorite part is the party scene at the cottage.
Okay.
Which is me really leaning heavily into the like fairy magic idea from Midsummer Night's Dream. In the play, there's all these themes of mistaken identity, and the fairies are putting drops from the flower that confuses you and makes you fall in love with others. And then I kind of did my contemporary spin on that. And that scene was really, really fun to write and really hard to write because I had to totally alter the perspective of my narrator. She's not quite herself in that moment. So it was very fun, but technically really tricky. And then trying to make it feel really loose and organic while, you know, pulling a lot of puppet strings. And I love the canoeing scene. There is a scene where, and it's not a funny scene, and it's a really grounding scene for me. That's like quite a touchstone. Yeah, and I love when Miranda and her high school love are in flashback, and they are and they're like teenage blooming
the tender
showmance. Yeah. And like I had my first kiss in a school play, and you know, and it's so awkward, and it's so its torment. And, you know, it was fun to go yes. back and play with that stuff.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I was in a school play with my then high school boyfriend, and we had to kiss on stage. But like kissing in front of people when you kiss off stage is very hard to do. Yes. Having somebody direct you is very strange.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So.
Yeah. I think my favorite scene is when the curse befalls the production and then the like teamwork that has to come together. I love that moment. There's so many wonderful moments in the play. Yeah, no, it's so good.
Thank you.
We're so excited for everybody to read it. So a couple more things. I had a note of one of my questions. Has your poet dad read the book? And so the answer is yes, your lovely dad has read the book.
He has, and he's not my target audience by a mile. And it makes me happy to know that it still lands.
Yes.
Even if you're not a 70-year-old poet.
Oh, I love that. So what are some advice you have for writers? So you've written a memoir. You've written your current drawer novel. You've written this incredible book, Midsummer Nights. So you tried your hand at some things. Mm-hmm. What kind of advice do you have for our listeners who are, most of them are aspiring authors?
I mean, advice is, it's all been said. I was thinking you might ask me this, and I was like, what can I say that's new? Anything you can do to regulate your nervous system. I know that sounds like a joke, but for real, the anxiety is mighty. The waiting, like waiting in between submissions. I found for us, like me asking you not to send me rejections. And then I kind of will come to you for them when I have braced myself. Because, mm-hmm. you know, depending on the wrong day, a rejection or a bad review can just derail the writing. And then it's, you know, time wasted. I'm finding that now because I'm starting to access, you know, NetGalley reviews and Goodreads reviews. And, you know, everyone says don't read them. And they're right. And then I call myself a freelance teacher now. So I'm a substitute teacher. I'm on a contract right now, but then I can, you know, generally kind of control how much freedom I have and how much time I have. But I did write 2 full books while teaching full time. And that happened largely just because I was ruthless with the time I would create for myself. I tend to like go off into the woods for a few days and binge write, as Cheryl Strayed calls it. But I also, you know, would run out on my lunch break and write, you know, a couple of pages at a Starbucks or write something on the subway or just whenever you can. I dictate in my car. Like I'll just start saying my book out loud. And that's a really fast way for me to get content. And it's a hot mess. But, you know, so it takes a lot of editing, but it's a good way to when you just don't have time. So just being really creative with finding ways to generate whatever you're working on, because there's not usually, you know, time and space and energy. You just kind of have to be committed to it. And then I find the more distance, like it's like a relationship. You need to stay in touch with your book. I can't get too far away. Right now I'm working on something new. I'm really excited about it, but you know, work has me removed from it. So I'm out of touch with it a little bit. It's really hard to get back in. So staying in the flow, staying in touch with your book, like any muscle, I mean, anything that you want to have continued access to, I find I need to stay in the zone, even in these tiny little micro ways. And then, you know, get comfortable with uncertainty. And I'm someone who's like a doer. I like to strong arm the universe and make things happen. You, the writer, you don't get to choose who signs you always. You don't get to choose when that happens. You don't get to choose like what editor says yes. Not that you have no agency and you have no say, but a lot of these things are up to fate, up to chance. And that is not my default setting, surrendering to the universe. So you just have to, like, that's something I'm still learning, and just being able to kind of go with the flow and trust the timing and all that healthy stuff that writers and artists don't always default to.
Absolutely. No, those are incredible lessons, and I'm sure everybody really appreciates all of your thoughts. And I'm so excited for everybody to read the book. So now's your chance to pre-order it. Midsummer Nights, out at the end of June. Make sure you pre-order your copy. It will be available in print, in audiobook, in ebook, so whatever format you choose. We love it so much. If you're looking on YouTube, you can see I'm holding up the cover. It has all these little fairies on it and all of this kind of beautiful details. And I'm just so excited for everybody to read it. It's so special.
Yeah.
And very charming, very good, like summer beach read, book club read, all of the reads. And we hope everybody enjoys. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Carly.
The best part about where I live is that when spring and summer comes, your outdoor space is an extension of your living space. When we moved in, we kept our deck the way it was, which meant that we needed to get creative about how to maximize its use. The layout was a bit wonky, but with Wayfair, you can find pieces that fit your outdoor space no matter what the size and dimensions. When you have the right pieces from Wayfair, your space fits your style and your budget. If you don't have an outdoor rug yet, you need to get one now. It frames your space and makes it feel like a living room and very intentional. You can bring your interior style design into your outdoor space, making it a seamless transition for hosting or just enjoying for yourself. If you haven't tried Wayfair yet, you're missing out on the experience of options that fit your space, style, and budget like no other. Outdoor seating, grills, major appliances, storage, patio lighting, rugs, decor. Wayfair is your one-stop shop for home. My favorite Wayfair feature is Wayfair Verified, your shortcut to the good stuff. Their team of product specialists vet everything by hand using a 10-point inspection, testing things like quality of materials, functionality and features, and even how long it takes to build. Take the guesswork out of ordering online and have complete confidence. Patio season is here and these deals won't last. Head to Wayfair.com right now to get your outdoor space ready for way less. That's Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
If you're like me and have travel coming up, whether it's a late spring break, summer vacations, weddings abroad, or international work trips, imagine arriving actually understanding the language, ordering confidently at restaurants, connecting with locals at museums, feeling immersed instead of just visiting. We are headed to the Alps very soon with the kids and some friends of ours, and I can't wait to order my beer in German. Ein großes Bier, bitte. Okay, I need some work, but I will get there because Rosetta Stone has been a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb your new language. No memorizing, random vocabulary lists, and no relying on translations. Instead, you learn by connecting words, visuals, and meaning in context. The way language is meant to be learned. My German will soon get better because of the true accent feature, which is designed to give real-time feedback on pronunciation. Lessons are simple to add to your regular schedule every day with the app or desktop fitted in, whether you have 5 minutes or an hour. Learn faster, retain longer. Rosetta Stone helps you in your new language naturally, helping you think and communicate with confidence. Ready to start learning a new language this spring? Visit rosettastone.com/today to explore Rosetta Stone and choose the language that's right for you. Go to rosettastone.com/today now and begin your language learning journey.
Hi, everyone. Today's guest is the author of The Assistants and When Katie Met Cassidy. She has worked as a books editor for Cosmopolitan and Esquire. She has also been a ghostwriter of young adult novels and a reference librarian. She holds a Bachelor of Arts degree from New York University, where she majored in English and Gender and Sexuality Studies, and a Master's of Library Science degree from Queens College. She splits her time between New York City and the Hudson Valley with her wife and their Brussels Griffin named Pip. It's my pleasure to welcome Camille Perry. Camille, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. So Camille and I shared a publisher and a publicist when our debuts were coming out. And that always feels like a really special connection. But besides that, Camille, your Brussels Griffin, Pip, was the first one that I ever saw. I remember you posting it to social media and I was like, what the hell is this?
I totally understand that response because the first time I saw Brussels Griffon, I had the exact same response. Yeah. Well, I'm delighted that I was the one to introduce you to the breed.
Well, yeah. And then afterwards, I forgot the name and I kept telling my friends, you must see this Higgs boson, which is an entirely different thing.
Close enough.
And we're getting more in Toronto now because Toronto is more of a like a French bulldog sort of city. It's either golden retrievers or French bulldogs, but I've seen more and more of them here, which has been so cute because it just looks so perpetually grumpy and dissatisfied.
Exactly. Yeah. Perfect dog for a grump like me. Yeah. Well, they're more popular in cities because they're tiny.
Yeah.
They're a tiny dog. So, you know, I think in cosmopolitan places, they're a little bit more popular than.
Yeah. I think I was scared to ever get one because I'm a chronic people pleaser, and to have a dog look at me and it looks so perpetually dissatisfied. But now we've adopted the world's grumpiest cat, and he also just sits and stares at me like I'm doing everything wrong. So I think it's actually been good for my personal journey and self-development. So there you go.
I'm sure that's true. Yeah.
Okay, let's dive into the book. So for everybody who is not watching on YouTube, I'm holding up the cover. It is so cute. So we've got that grumpy face on there called Social Animals, and that's the book we're discussing today. I'm going to read you the logline and then the flap copy, and then we're going to dive in. So, logline. Primates of Park Avenue meets Finley Donovan is killing it in a witty and fast-paced comedy about three women whose fates collide part at a dog park in affluent suburban Maryland. Val Caruso, Alex Reed, and June Kennison come from completely different worlds. Val is a tough-talking private investigator. Alex is reticent, nervous, and on the run from her past. And June is an athlete-turned-housewife whose true love is her pup. When Val is hired by June's husband to find out if June is cheating on him, it sets these three women on a collision course. Amid a colorful cast of characters who spend time at the shabby but beloved Hamilton Dog Park, they find they have more in common than they thought. Soon, June is nearly brave enough to aim for what she wants. Alex finds excitement she never expected, and Val is reluctantly opening her heart to the most high-maintenance dog she's ever met. But when their secrets catch up with them, will their newfound friendships be able to withstand the pressure, or will they find themselves in the doghouse? Dun, dun, dun. Okay, so I really love a good genre blend, Camille, and I find that all of your books have sort of straddled genres. I've read all of them, and it would be interesting to hear you classify each of them in terms of genre.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation. Of course, another writer would notice something like that. Yeah, my first book it can be considered a heist. The Assistants was sort of a heist novel about a group of assistants who use their billionaire boss's expense account to pay off their student loan debt. My second novel was When Katie Met Cassidy, which is a queer rom-com. Sits pretty clearly in that genre. And this one is a little bit, it's got a little bit suspense aspect. I wouldn't like call it a thriller or a suspense novel hardcore, but it definitely does bump up against that genre for sure. And yeah, I never planned on having each book sort of fit into a different genre. And I don't think marketing and publicity loves that, because what they love is for their authors to be easily categorized, easily labeled. And I think I sort of defy that a little bit. But yeah, it's kept me on my toes as a writer to do kind of things a little bit differently each time. It's kept it new and exciting for me every time.
Yeah, it's true what you say. Publishers do prefer to be able to say, you're a historical fiction author, and this is where you sit on the shelves. And so it does make it a little bit harder to market. But for someone like me, when I see a Camille Perry book come out, I'm like, interesting. I can't wait to see what she's done here, because I know it's not going to be formulaic. It's not going to be the same thing. And we're seeing a lot more genre blends. So I think it's thanks to authors like you who've been doing that, that makes it easier for authors to do it going forward.
Well, thank you for saying that. That means more to me than anything you can know. Like, that's just music to my ears.
Does your agent freak out every time you're like, oh, I have this idea and it's very different? Or is your agent like, okay, God, here we go?
My agent is very open to anything. She's easy breezy. She's super supportive. I think that it's more the publishing house people who are, you know, the ones who the money's at stake. I think they worry more, because everybody likes the same but different. They like a reliable thing. So I think that's where it gets a little more tricky.
What I found interesting is that we chat quite regularly with Emily Summer, who's a book buyer at East City Bookshop. And she was saying that when it comes to these kinds of genres, you know, because it's always like, where on the bookshelf is this book going to go? And she was saying that they will change it up according to their own clientele, because they know what their clientele specifically likes. So one bookstore might put the book on, you know, mystery shelves, but they would put it somewhere else specifically. And I think that's also so important, is for the booksellers to know how to position it. And once they figure that out, I think the rest is easy because then they're pretty much hand selling it.
And that really speaks to the wonder of independent bookstores too, because they're the ones who really know their clientele, right? Like a huge big box store isn't going to cater to their readers in such a specific way. So yeah. It's really a shout out to the indies that they do that.
Yeah, amazing shout out to our indies always. All right, what I'd love now, Camille, is for you to please read us your prologue.
I would love to. It's a lonely life being astray. Did you know feeling lonely activates the same part of the brain that processes physical pain? That's why rejection hurts as bad as it does. Because the need for connection and belonging is evolutionary, stemming from a past where isolation meant increased vulnerability to danger. Today, isolation is differently dangerous, but no less so. For a dog with enough time spent alone, without anyone to trust, starving for kindness, a change happens, and that aloneness becomes a personality. You see this clearly at the park, the extroverts running around, kicking dust into the eyes of the introverted loners looking on from afar. Of course, not all who are solitary are unhappy. But the fact is, once an animal's been socialized, it's tough to change it, whether they're happy that way or not. People are no different. That's my opinion, anyway. Bringing a stranger into a group, one who doesn't play well with others, and the dynamic shifts. New packs form. Sometimes a fight breaks out. Sometimes someone gets hurt. So, what happened at Hamilton Dog Park came as no surprise to me. I was there. I saw it all. And for months, I'd been telling anyone who would listen, someone here is going to end up dead.
I love it. Right. So we're always talking about intentionality on the podcast, and I love to see how a work evolves. So was this prologue always there? Was it something you started with? Was it something you came to later? How did that get in there?
I always had a prologue. I really like framing devices. I'm a big fan of them in general. I like reading them and I like writing them. The prologue did change over time. There had been a different prologue, which was similar, but I hadn't yet landed the voice. The voice was a little bit different. I wasn't yet totally clear on whose voice I wanted the prologue in, and that's a little bit part of the mystery, is you don't know whose voice the prologue is in till the very end. So it did change over time. I don't want to say too much because I don't want any spoilers, but yeah, the prologue was always there, but I continuously updated it. And I did know like what I wanted the prologue to accomplish. I knew that I wanted it to set a certain tone of the novel and make it intriguing enough that people would then want to go on to chapter one. That was always the intention with the prologue.
Right. And then we have the epilogue, which I also don't want to give too much away, but it was so fascinating to begin with that. Like you say, a framing device. So when we talk about intentionality, when it comes to point of view, you could have had like, there's the omniscient narrator, right? Like as you begin the story, you can decide that this dog is the omniscient narrator of the entire story. You could say that we begin with this narrator who's not omniscient, and then we have three third person close kind of POVs. So when you sat down, what was your intention in terms of how that would all play out?
I knew that I wanted each of the three main characters to have their own POV. I knew that I wanted it alternating third person close because that was the most useful to me, because there's a lot of secrets and lies in this book. And so I needed all three of their points of view. This book would not have worked if I did a first person point of view from a single character, because there just wouldn't have been, you wouldn't have had all the mystery and intrigue, and the reader wouldn't know certain things that the characters didn't yet know and all that fun stuff. So I'm always very intentional about point of view. It's one of the first things I try to figure out when I sit down to write a book. I mean, I think you have to, but I know some writers try it in different ways and then see what works best. But I sort of have an instinct for it and just knew sitting down that this was going to be a three-person point of view from each. And I knew that one of the three had to sort of be an anchor. Like even if you have, you know, the group, you really do want, and I believe it should be the person that you start with. I think the first voice that people hear is the one that they sort of automatically, it's like a firstborn kid, I guess. It's like the first one they bond with. And so I knew that Val was going to be a little bit of the lead, a little bit of the anchor character.
Yeah, it is so difficult because one, people do bond with the first voice faster, which means you've got to work that much harder on each of the other POV voices. But as well, if you consider that the standard novel is 80,000 words, if you have a single POV character to develop them in 80,000 words, you've got room to play around with. But when you have three POV characters, that greatly reduces the amount of time that the reader spends with them. And so you as the writer have got to work that much harder to get the reader on board with them, even if they are curmudgeonly, even if they are, I hate using unlikable narrators, especially when it comes to women. I like a complex person who you have to work a little bit harder to get on board with, but it makes it that much harder for you as the writer.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I think one nice workaround with that is with three different POVs, you do get everybody's observation of everybody else. So you get to see them from the inside as well as the outside. And it's nice if those things sort of, there's a little friction there, like if they rub up against each other a little bit. But yeah, it's nice to be able to see someone from exterior and interior. My first book I wrote in first person, and at the time I always thought every book I was going to write was going to be in first person. That was just what came really natural to me. And then I thought with my second book that I needed two points of view. So I really pushed myself to be able to write in third person. And now I can't imagine going back. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. And again, intentionality, you could have had one character here be a first person kind of POV and others, you know, third person close, etc. So we're always saying to our listeners, just be really intentional with what you choose. If characters have got secrets, be aware that like if you put them in first person, we have closer interiority to those secrets, whereas third person, you can remove it a bit. And for me, that's always circling the building. I call it circling the building at the beginning to figure out my best entry point. And voice is so important there as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, voice, I think novels live and die by voice. That's my theory. I think there's so many things that you can tinker with. But voice is really going to make or break your novel. And when you have different points of view, you do need the voices to be distinct from one another. It has to be unified enough as a whole. It's sort of like if you're a musician writing an album, you know, each song sounds like its own song, but all of them still sound like the artist. I think that's the secret sauce of voice when you're doing different points of view. But yeah, you don't want your characters to sound too much alike.
I love that analogy. And again, if you're writing a multi-POV novel with a man who's in his 80s and a woman who's 20, whatever, again, it makes it easier to differentiate the characters. But you've got three women here, all have dogs. I mean, they're very different women, but still, again, on the page, you've got to hit the ground running in terms of differentiating them so that the reader's not like, okay, which one's Val, which one's June? Is that something that comes to you while you're writing, Camille? Like, what's your process? Are you a plotter, a pantser? Do you figure it all out before you begin, or are you feeling your way in the dark as you go along?
I'm very much a plotter. I do plot. I like to plan everything sort of out before I sit down to write. However, once I do sit down to write, dialogue always comes to me first. It's just the thing. I hear the voices of the characters before anything else. So a lot of times my first draft of a first chapter will be very dialogue heavy. And I'm sort of, I've got the back and forth between the characters, but a lot of what I don't have is exposition. I don't necessarily have a lot of setting, a description of the setting. All of those things come out later. And then sometimes I even write a little note to myself as I'm writing where I write emotion TK, meaning this is a place where I need to slow down and really get into what's going on beneath the exterior scene. But I'm not going to do that on this pass. I'm going to get to that later. You know, I'll do that in like a second, a third, or third pass. Because dialogue is just, it comes when it's coming. You want to get it down because it's like magic when the characters are kind of talking to you.
I love that layered approach to writing because I tend to have a layered approach to editing, but I'm the same as you. Dialogue comes to me first, and you're right. When the dialogue's flowing, like there'll be some days where I just write the whole thing out in dialogue, and then afterwards you've got to write the action beats and the gestures and the setting, etc. But it makes sense because you've also done script writing, haven't you?
I did. Both my first two novels were optioned and I was attached as screenwriter. I wrote scripts for both of those. Neither of them got made. So there is that. However, I did learn how to write a script in that process, and I enjoyed it a lot. And I think if you are a writer who tends to enjoy dialogue, script writing is sort of a natural jump for you. I enjoyed script writing a lot, and I'd like to do more of it. I actually, funny enough, Social Animals started out as a script that I was, an original feature script that I was trying to write. And because it was after I did my two adaptations, and I thought, wow, 100 pages, you know, real fast. Why am I a novelist? Like, why am I working years on all these pages and all that? And I was like, this is the best. I'm going to just be a script writer now. So I was trying to write the early version of what became Social Animals was a script. It was sort of, I had the characters of Val and Alex, and it was sort of a female buddy comedy where they were trying to solve a crime together. Pretty quickly, I figured out it wasn't going to work. It wasn't working. And that I actually am a novelist. I got really attached to the characters. And I thought, oh, I'm going to write a novel for these characters. So I actually pulled them right out of that script, created a new plot. And that was how I started writing the novel that would become Social Animals.
Again, I love that evolution. And the thing is, your work is so cinematic. So it's really cinematic. But the difference, obviously, between a script and a novel is that interiority and that emotionality is that we have access to that constantly, what the character's thinking, what they're feeling, and if there's contradictions, etc. I think, yeah, it's getting that balance, right? It's having the scene play out so that you can see it on the screen, but also giving us that access constantly to their thoughts and feelings.
Yeah. You want to reach out when a reader least expects it and just grab hold of their heart, right? Like, that's how I think of it. And if you're writing a script, there's not the opportunity for that. And I sort of missed it. What I love about, and your writing style is this way too. I think you're writing stuff and it's, the reader's like, I'm having a good time. And then all of a sudden, oh, I'm feeling feelings, you know? And I love that. And you really can only get that in a novel, you know, or like a good TV show.
Writing humor and balancing it with those like warm and fuzzies is also really difficult because you have such a wry sense of humor. A lot of that comes through in the dialogue. There's parts where I'm laughing out loud. And I think capturing a funny voice can be difficult because sometimes it can go too far. It can become too campy or too over the top if that's not what you're intending. Obviously, if that's what you're intending, great. So again, what's your advice for writers who are trying to balance the humor with the warm and fuzzies?
I think my advice would be in your first draft, no holds barred. Go over the top. If you need to go over the top, you can always pull it back. My challenge is editing myself as I write. So I'm always trying to turn off the editor while I'm being the writer and creating. And I think that's hard to do, but I encourage writers to do that. And then once you have a nice draft going or chapter, have your trusted readers, have your people who have your best interest in mind and are honest with you, but not so critical that they break you down like a horse, but your trusted readers who you trust their opinions and they're going to tell you the truth, and have them give you a read and tell you, right, do a line edit. You know, this is a little too much for me. I think you went too far here. Here you could go a little farther. You know, I think it's so important to have those other people because that is very difficult to gauge for yourself.
Yeah. I like to do that early in the process. Like with my first however many chapters, you know, I want to know that I'm nailing the voice. I want to know that I'm nailing my entry into it. For you, is that something that comes after you've got the first draft down, or do you get that feedback as you're going along?
I write in like batches, like chapter batches. So I'll always either write like the first 3 to 5 chapters and then take a pause because I think those are the most difficult chapters to get right, and they set the tone for the rest of the thing. So I'll spend a lot of time on those first 5. But once I kind of get those first 5 into a place where I'm like, okay, this is rolling now, the rest kind of comes easier. So I'll probably do my first 5 and then spend a long time on them alone without any feedback because too many cooks spoil the broth. I don't want too many opinions too early on. But once it's in a place where I'm almost like, I don't know where else to go with this. I don't know what else to do with it. I know that I'm ready for another reader. So I'll get my most trusted readers on probably the first 5 chapters. And then what I like to do is do the next 5. I always like to sort of do first 10. I think the first 10 chapters, by then, even if you're going to submit a part, like if you're a writer and you could submit a partial, I don't recommend new writers submit partials. I think they should write complete manuscripts. But if they're even just trying to get an agent, I think, you know, an agent might take you on a partial. I don't know. But I think 10 chapters is like the best amount of chapters to do that with, because it saves you so much of having to write the whole novel. But by chapter 10, your reader knows if they're going to finish this book or not. And you've got a lot going on by then.
I even feel like by chapter 3 these days, people's attention spans are just not what they used to be. I feel like you've got to grab them straight out the gate. But I agree, like by chapter 10, you're figuring things out. And with each decision you make in the story, you're kind of closing off avenues for yourself. I call it like getting on the highway. And in the beginning, there are so many on-ramps and off-ramps. But as you make each story or plot decision, it kind of closes off options for you. So you really need to know where you're going at that point.
Absolutely. I agree with that wholeheartedly.
Yeah. So you've written in your acknowledgements about working with your editor on how many drafts to really elevate the first draft. Can you speak a bit about that, like the backwards and forwards? Because a lot of our listeners don't yet have editors and don't yet know what that process looks like. So what was it like for you specifically?
Well, I had worked on this novel for a really long time before I sold it. It had been a number of years. There had been a number of different renditions of it. I had gone over it with my agent. There was a lot. So by the time I sold it to Putnam, it was pretty clean. So I didn't have like a hardcore gutting of the novel, but it was sort of at the place where it was just about there, but it just needed that last kind of jump, you know, and Kate kind of came in and helped solidify a lot of things that were questionable, like, should I do this? Should I do that? Things that had changed. She kind of came in and gave her opinion on which direction she thought it should go. And, you know, what I like about working with a professional editor is that they generally know what they're talking about, right? You can kind of trust them, but your vision needs to be aligned with theirs. But sometimes you're going to disagree with something that they say, or you'll take a note and you'll realize, okay, I hear what they're saying and I see what the problem is, but the thing that they suggested to correct it maybe doesn't gel with you. You kind of take the note below the note or whatever they say, and you address the issue, but you address it in your own way to solve the problem, not necessarily, maybe you don't really want to do what they suggested you do. And I think the best editors are totally cool with that. And they're not going to be like, well, you didn't take this suggestion, you know. But I think that's how the process tends to work for everyone.
Yeah. And, you know, something that drives me bonkers is when I'm writing is you change something and it feels like it's something small. But it's like unraveling a thread, because if you don't follow that change through later on, the character doesn't feel authentic because, you know, they're behaving in a way that they wouldn't have behaved in the earlier draft if you hadn't changed that. So it's so important to keep track of all those changes. And that's why you need external readers, because sometimes you forget that something changed and they're like, I'm confused here. And you go back and you're like, yeah, no shit, because I forgot to change that.
It's so true. Yeah. You get so close to it, right? You get to the point where you're so close to it, you can't even see it anymore. And that's why, in addition to other writers, I think it's really important to set something aside for a good few weeks to few months, if you can, and go back to it with fresh eyes, because you need to forget some stuff. And then there's just nothing like fresh eyes. There's nothing like it. And the only way you could get it is time. You have to be so patient to be able to set something aside. But yeah, you're totally right. It's like, I think of it as like Jenga. We're like, oh, I'm going to change this one thing. And it's like, poof, you know, like there goes, you know. Yeah, it's, yeah. And that's funny too, when you're getting feedback from people, because especially non-writers, if you get feedback from just readers, they love to just have ideas, right? And they well, what if you tried this? Or like, wait a second, what if this? And you're like, I can't do that, because that would be rewriting like the entire thing, you know. But people mean well. It's just because they get excited.
I know. But every now and again, there will be something that someone will mention that will require an entire rewrite, and you're so resistant to it. And then suddenly you're like, oh my God, that'll actually make it so much better. And then you just have to do the whole rewrite. Do you have time for one more question?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we talk about intentionality again with regards to setting. So, you know, you live in New York and you backwards and forwards between, but you very particularly based this in Maryland for a very particular reason. So can we speak again about the intentionality with setting, that it's not just some backdrop in the background, that setting informs story and character and plot development?
I wanted to set it in an affluent suburb because I wanted the kinds of dog owners that were going to be a little bit ridiculous with their dogs. I wanted to poke a little bit of fun at that. And that said, I'm poking fun at myself because over the COVID pandemic, my wife and I had moved to Maryland. We didn't live in Bethesda. We lived in Rockville, Maryland. But that was where we were when we got our dog. And that was where I began going to the dog park. And that was where I got the idea to write a novel whose setting was in a dog park. So Maryland kind of came out of there. I wanted it to be in an affluent suburb in Maryland also because I loved the idea, and I learned this when I was living there. A lot of people who live in the suburbs around DC work in government, or they work in, you know, they work in the government. Some of them might work for the military. Some of them might work for the FBI. Some of them might work for the CIA. Like, you don't, people have very interesting jobs there, and they don't always talk about them forthright. And so when I was living there, I was always saying to my wife, do you think that guy's a spy? You know, any one of these people could be a spy. I'm like, this one works, is very vague about what government work they do. I'm like, what do you think they do? Do you think they're a CIA agent? You know? And so my wife would laugh at me, but I thought, you know, in terms of having, I put that into Val's head a little bit because I thought it was super interesting just, and setting specific, like if you can have something in your book that's very unique to a certain place, I think that's so lucky and you have to capitalize on that. So I knew I wanted to put that into the book because I thought it was just like super fun and interesting.
I love that. I imagined all these spies at the dog park. It made me think of years ago at a Toronto dog park, there was a woman who would walk around. She was always listening to podcasts, what I assumed was podcasts, and she had a little black Scotty. But if anyone had said to me, what is her occupation? I would have gone kindergarten teacher, right? You just look at people and you make assumptions. And it turned out much later that she was a private investigator.
Oh my goodness.
And an investigative journalist. And I was like, whoa, you must be so good at your job because no one's going to see you around and be like, okay, she's spying on me.
I mean, that story writes itself, right? I mean, that is just, you can't make it up any better.
Yeah, absolutely. Camille, we've come to the end of our time. I had so many more questions, but thank you so much for your incredible answers. I'm holding up Social Animals again. We link to it on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you get the book there, you support an independent bookstore and a podcast at the same time. And we know you're going to love this one. We hope to see you back for the next one, Camille.
I'd love to. Thank you so much.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. So I recently grabbed lunch with an acquiring editor from HarperCollins who told me that the number of submissions she's been getting has nearly doubled. And I wasn't surprised at all because every agent and editor I know has been talking about how the volume of submission keeps increasing. So personally, that is a wonderful thing because it's more reading for me, but it also means I have more chances of matching with authors. I consider it a privilege to review queries on Books with Hooks and, of course, in my submissions inbox. But at the same time, I talk to writers who tell me that they wish agents would read more than a few pages because, and I quote, my story gets better in chapter 2. I have to be honest, this kills me. It's like me wanting chocolate chip cookies to have the nutritional value of kale. It's just not realistic. Like it or not, no agent, no acquiring editor is going to stick around to see if a submission gets better. It's not because we're mean, it's because we get dozens and dozens every day. I know it's harsh, but ambitious writers embrace harsh realities. So here it goes. It's your job to make your opening pages irresistible, to make agents crave it, to make agents want to read more. That's why I'm so excited about my upcoming course, Starting It Right. how to begin your story in the best place and in the best way. I created this course after studying hundreds of books. I've mapped out elements that are present in the beginning of all successful novels and memoirs. And I've designed checklists, actual checklists, that you can use to ensure that your story's beginning is seducing your reader. We'll cover how to write a great first line, different types of beginnings, and how you can choose the best one, the best place to start, and the best way to start. Yes, these are totally different things. When it makes sense to add a prologue and when it doesn't, how to frame your inciting incident in an appealing way, how to balance exposition and mystery, how to include context but not weigh it down with too much backstory, and what to do if your story has more than one POV or timeline. Most of all, I'm going to show you how to make readers want to turn to chapter 2. Join me for this multi-day course designed to help you break through the noise. You'll leave with a clear, actionable breakdown of exactly what goes into a terrific beginning. If you've already signed up, come prepared to take lots of notes. We're talking hundreds of slides with real-world examples and specific techniques, plus a super fun surprise that I can't wait to share. I hope to see you there.